The 7th of July 1940 in the Mediterranean and Africa, British forces destroy the French fleet to stop them falling into German hands. Another dimension to the work is discussed in the 34th letter, the direct use of occult methods to sap morale and influence the group souls of the nations. Letter number 34, for July 7, 1940. If we as a nation make ourselves a channel of cosmic law through realization of the spiritual nature of the struggle we are waging, we become the channel for the manifestation of the power of God, and the stars in their courses will literally fight for us, as they did in the weather conditions attending the evacuation of the BEF from Dunkirk, when the storm and the calm fell exactly as needed and even the military authorities talked of a miracle. But the weapons of our adversaries' warfare are not wholly carnal, either. We have seen the peculiar way in which the morale of nation after nation falls suddenly to pieces when courage and loyalty could have saved the day. This is due to a form of fifth column activity which has not received the recognition which is its due. In fact, so specialized and unrecognized is it that we might justly talk of sixth column activities. These activities are purely mental. Hitler's well-known psychological methods form part of them, but there is more to it than that. We are, in my opinion, dealing with definite occult forces being used telepathically on the group souls of nations, and finding channels of expression through the subconsciousness of susceptible people who lack spiritual principles. I am satisfied that we are not the only group that is broadcasting to the subconscious mind of the race, and that just as we have found ourselves able to pour in spiritual power, others, using similar methods, are trying to undermine our morale. This is a serious matter, and we must not shrink from facing it. But, on the other hand, 9 months' steady work lies behind us. We have built up something very strong and definite. Those who come to meet us in the light have established their contacts with the group mind of the race, and I believe the situation to be well in hand provided we do not allow ourselves to relax our vigilance or let ourselves be deceived by specious pseudo-idealism. There is not room for Nazism and democratic civilization on the same globe, and one or the other will have to get off it. Let us bear this constantly in mind when subtle attacks come to be made on our morale, as they certainly will be when force proves expensive. There is one sure protection against this subversive telepathy: spiritual principles, clearly realized ideals, and dedication to them, even unto death. In order to counteract this telepathic undermining of the group mind, which showed itself first in complacency and unsuspiciousness of the obvious, and from which we have only recently awakened, we must have not merely physical courage, but a spiritual basis to our morale that shall lift us right above the level on which subversive telepathy works. We must take our stand on spiritual values in national life, and then no fear of destruction of property or the sufferings of individuals will cause us to sell our birthright for a scrap of paper. The 4th of August 1940, the German air offensive against Britain is postponed because of bad weather conditions. Deeper implications of the unseen warfare are developed in the 36th letter. There is a deeply positive optimism in Diane Fortune's remarks at this time, and it may be recalled that these were written in the August of 1940, the time of the Battle of Britain, the country's finest and darkest hour, when, in Churchill's later words, so many owed so much to so few. Letter number 36, for August 4, 1940. There is something very strange about this war. The nations that have been subjugated were not beaten in the field, they fell to treachery and internal corruption, to lack of morale and lack of the will to victory. The key to their fall may be found in the words, "He who would save his life shall lose it, and he who will lose his life for my sake shall find it." Those who prefer security to freedom have lost both. England stands alone and happy. All war gloom has gone. There is confidence in the future and pride in the present. Power is rising within us like a tide. The inflowing of a new life impulse is making itself felt. The 8th of September 1940 in London, 412 people die and 747 are injured in bombing attacks. Hitler delays his invasion plans. As the aerial warfare over London was hatting up, In the 41st letter we find Diane Fortune giving advice on how to meditate and maintain a serene mind in the midst of distractions and dangers. Although few students may have to put up with the conditions of war she describes, nonetheless the advice remains sound for coping with the lesser trials of life that seem to conspire against esoteric work. Letter number 41, for September 8, 1940. There is only one way to keep quiet and serene under bombardment: to be prepared to lay down your life for your country if necessary. Once that eventuality is accepted, one abrogates one's civilian mentality, and the passivity and helplessness that go with it. Regard the warning wail of the siren as an alert, not as a retreat, unless specifically ordered to get out of the way. Carry on as near normal as you can without running undue risks. So much for the end to be aimed at. Let us now consider how, from the esoteric point of view, it can best be achieved. People should, by now, have got used to being wailed at, and have learnt to judge by the familiar sounds how far the threatened danger is immediate. Then, having taken what precautions you can, accept the residue of the risk with fortitude. When the actual bombing starts, or the sound of gunfire is alarmingly near, go into meditation, if possible assuming the meditation posture. Now this may seem impossible of achievement during the din of a raid, and so it would be for the untrained mind, but if preparations have been made in advance, it will prove unexpectedly easy, for the stress of an air raid heightens psychic perception, and many a person will witness the parting of the veil and see into the unseen who, under normal conditions, might have to work long before they achieved such an experience. Each person should compose for themselves a short mantram, or rhythmical sentence of invocation of the masters to be present and protect, and should repeat it silently like a litany until the mental turmoil ceases and it is possible to perform meditation proper. If the turmoil can be stilled even for a few seconds, it will be possible to pick up the inner contacts with every probability of vision opening and enabling us to see the work going on the inner planes, for the invisible helpers come very close to Earth at these times. Try and make contact with these, not in order that they may protect you, but that you may cooperate with them in helping those around you. You will find them very ready to avail themselves of your cooperation, for their problem is to establish contact with the people they are trying to help, who, not being psychic, are very difficult for them to influence. It is in such circumstances as these that the value of steady, regular meditation shows itself, and if you have learnt to discipline the mind and enter into the quiet amid the distractions of everyday life, which so many people allege prevent them from meditation, then you may have the great experience of seeing the heavens open when the stress of the moment has given just that extra turn of the screw that makes consciousness change gear. During our meditation on Sunday, we were conscious of the coming of a messenger, and it is probable that steps are being taken to establish contact and cooperation with those who work as invisible helpers in close touch with the Earth's sphere. It would therefore be well, when danger threatens, to formulate the Rose Cross in the same way that you would put up a notice indicating that there is a stirrup pump in your house, so that any invisible helper who is working in your environment may know where to look for cooperation, but to remember that to do this involves willingness to sacrifice yourself if necessary. The 15th of September 1940, following extensive losses of aircraft in the Battle of Britain, Hitler delays his invasion plans indefinitely. However, the Blitz continues. The theme of inner plane cooperation and protection is developed in the next letter also. Letter number 42, for September 15, 1940. Under stress, the directing intelligence is apartment to be abrogated, and the subconsciousness to come up and take charge. Then it is that the regular practice of meditation shows its value, for we find that what comes up is a disciplined subconsciousness, filled with the meditation images that we have so laboriously impressed upon it during the long months of systematic work that lie behind us. Automatically the images appear and do their work, holding us steady and on our contact, even as we, in the patient routine of daily meditation, have practiced holding them steady. But in addition to our physical plane precautions, let us have our meditation scheme planned and ready, and set it going with invocation and visualization as soon as danger threatens. We can plan to meet the masters in the cavern, or retire into the chapel of the Graal, and a power will come down upon us that will radiate to all around us, steadying the atmosphere and bringing calm and relaxation of tension, as some of our members have already proved. Until we begin to use these methods under conditions of stress, we have no idea what can be done with them. We fear to be credulous, or to be deceiving ourselves. But faith is necessary for any form of work that depends on mind power. Let us act as if what we want to believe is true, and we shall find that we have very likely brought it into manifestation. The results can be achieved in this way have to be seen to be believed. Advice on meditation under difficulties was soon put to the test, as can be seen in the opening paragraph of the 43rd letter, letter number 43 for September 22, 1940. Our meditation this week was conducted to the accompaniment of a dogfight at a low altitude immediately overhead and an incendiary bomb next door but one, and we have never had a more absolute sense of peace and power. And by the end of the following month the outer and inner conflict had become very closely interconnected, as letter 47 reveals. Letter number 47, for October 20th, 1940. At 3 Queensborough Terrace we had on Saturday night the experience of being straddled by a stick of 4 bombs, our headquarters just fitting neatly into the middle of them, and, though well shaken, escaping all damage. As the crashes drew nearer and nearer amid a concentration of AA fire, the conditions were such that the inner and outer planes seemed to merge, and it was possible to see the invisible helpers at work as innumerable shadowy presences. There were also presences of a much higher and more intellectual grade who seemed to be holding lines of power taut under great tension. Over all was the iridescent dome of protection guarded by great angelic presences. These are among the things we have been visualizing and building on the astral, and at the moment of testing it was a wonderful experience to see how potent and tangible they were. The stick of bombs fell one after the other in roads and gardens and there were no casualties. This is the second time that this has happened in our immediate vicinity. That there are powerful forces at work can hardly be denied. Our friends can help with the work of protection by frequent and regular invocation. Knowing that many must give their lives and sacrifice their property before the war is won, we have no right to ask that we should be spared and others taken, and indeed, if we do ask it, there appears to be no particular reason why the prayer should be granted. But if we have dedicated our lives to the service of the masters, then we are entitled to call down the power that shall protect us while we do the work we have undertaken, just as military headquarters are protected by defenses. We have offered our lives, and may be taken at our word in the course of our work, but until that time comes, we need conditions under which we can work efficiently, and it is a part of that work that we should build ourselves defenses. Therefore let our friends, and their friends, invoke for the protection of the dedicated priesthood and the dedicated places in the name of the Holy Rosicrucian Order, for calling upon the great ones of that order we make contact with them and open channels for their power to manifest on the physical plane. Indeed, at the moment of clear vision during the bombing, it was conveyed to us that the great and urgent need at the moment was for such channels to be opened freely and that we should be bold in making and invoking these contacts, not diffident and circumspect. It is with this great symbol that we have worked all these months, and we must make increasing use of it. During the past year it will be recalled that we worked for two things: the morale of the nation and a new world order when peace shall be declared. Now that the testing has come, the morale of the nation has proved itself to be beyond praise and the idea of regeneration and reconstruction is discussed on all hands. A new phase of our work is opening up and will be made clear in the course of the next weeks. The 27th of October 1940 during October, 6,350 civilians die, and 8,700 are injured in bombing raids. And despite the heroic and dedicated building of protective images the roof fell in, literally, in the following week, as Diane Fortune Riley explains. Letter number 48, for October 27, 1940. In our last letter we asked our members and friends to invoke for the protection of 3 Queensborough Terrace, and in this letter we have the ironical task of informing them that we have been bombed out of it, though without casualties, so it may be maintained that the invocation was at least a partial success, though your leader and her librarian look like a couple of sweeps owing to a difference of opinion with the roof, which fell in on them, but tactfully refrained from hitting them. It has often been alleged that Dion Fortune is a black occultist, and we regretfully admit that the allegation can no longer be denied. However, it is hoped that soap and water will restore her to the right-hand path and her students will once more be able to hold up their heads before a world always too ready to think the worst. The meditation meeting was held as usual despite the incident, and there was a wonderful sense of serene peace. Shocked people from next door were resting in the office, and they remarked on the peacefulness of the atmosphere. Later in the day the house was pronounced unsafe, and we had to evacuate. This is thought to be a precautionary measure, however, as there are no cracks in the walls. All the resident members are safely installed in our annex in the lower maisonette No. 21A Queensborough Terrace, Phone, Bay 6853. Everyone is serene and cheerful and quite unaffected by their experience, and we feel it may be fairly said that the method of mind training and thought control taught in the fraternity has proved its value. Our friends may like to know that although everything was thrown off the altar in the sanctuary, the statue of the risen Christ remained standing on its pedestal, though shifted to the very edge. The worst had passed within a couple of weeks, however, and things were getting back to normal. Letter number 50, for November 19, 1940. We have no further adventures to recount. We are grateful to say, save that by the time this letter is received 3 Queensborough Terrace will have been made weatherproof and we shall be contemplating the problem of getting it clean, unless, of course, we are rebombed in the meantime. The 24th of November 1940, in Berlin this week. The German High Command finishes its plans for the invasion of Russia Operation Barbarossa. The letters that follow, just over a year after the outbreak of war, take on a subtle change of function. They start to lay down general principles for the reconstruction of the country and the mysteries when hostilities are over. In letter 51, for example, there is a description of the initiate. Letter number 51, for November 24, 1940. The initiate works by what he is rather than by what he does, and the higher his grade, the more passive he appears to be on the physical plane. Should he take action thereon, he abrogates his power to operate on the inner planes, for one cannot be positive on both planes simultaneously. The initiate is what he is by virtue of the possession of certain basic qualities which are perfected by training. Firstly, he must not be self-centered, but in sympathetic relationship with all manifested life. Those who seek occult knowledge in order that it may help them in their troubles are a step nearer the path than those who seek it to satisfy a desire for knowledge, and these are in their turn a step further than those who seek it as a means to power, but they are not yet on the path. They may, it is true, receive help if there is a prospect that, being helped, they will make spiritual growth. But the work of those who train for initiation is not to help people, but to equip them to be helpers. Who would enroll as air raid wardens casualties lying on stretchers? So those who seek occult knowledge in order to find help in their troubles are apartment to find the dose too strong. Just as the ancient Hebrew law required the priests of the temple to be without maim or defect, so those who present themselves for the higher initiations must have worked out their personal troubles and find equilibrium and freedom before they dare to come to the altar. They are helped to do this work in the outer court and the lesser mysteries, but they may not enter upon the greater mysteries until it is done. The initiate of the greater mysteries is known by his serenity and impersonal attitude in all the relations of life. He knows how to be still and let the powers he has set in motion carry out the work. He knows how to await the ripening of souls and not force a premature development by personal pressure. The initiate never goes about doing good. He never trespasses uninvited upon spiritual privacy of another. He acts by what he is, not by what he does. He works on himself, makes something of himself, and then the forces that radiate from him without effort on his part bless and illuminate. If he is calm, he calms his environment. If he has wisdom, those who are in his company unconsciously take on his attitude, and he has no need to proffer unsolicited advice. Because he knows the reality of eternity, he is content to let time do its work. He is characterized by two things: the power to be still and wait, and the power to stand absolutely alone. Until we know how to be still, mentally as well as physically, we cannot handle power, and until we know how to stand absolutely alone in perfect equilibrium and contentment, we cannot accomplish the works that are done in polarity. Finally, the initiate is prepared to work without seeing results, playing his part on the great plan that unfolds through the ages of planetary time. The 12th of January 1941, the U.S. Congress finally passes the lease and lead bill, which allows President Roosevelt to supply Britain with massive amounts of military aid. The task of the initiate is further developed in the 56th letter, letter number 56, for January 12, 1941. It is our task, as esotericists, recognizing causation in the unseen and end results only on the plane of matter, to formulate in our minds the plan and concept of the new order of things that is being brought to birth on the circuit of cosmic time. The process goes through three phases. First, as leader, I have to obtain the realizations and teachings, then as a group we have to formulate them in meditation, finally, the individual members of the group have got to work them out in their own lives. Thus is the group mind of the race inoculated with the new concepts. Inoculation of the group mind can only take place when members of that group mind receive and act upon the ideas. Aliens cannot inoculate it. It will be noted that Hitler has always undermined a country through its own citizens, not through German-born agents. In order to alter environment by mind power, we commence by realizing the infinite and eternal energy of the great unmanifest. Each of us has as our nucleus of organization a spark of unmanifest life, and this divine spark is as inexhaustible in its energy as a grain of radium. By means of realization and formulation we build the machinery of its manifestation in our being, providing formulation is according to practicable cosmic law, and not wild fantasy. But just as an inventor may conceive a wonderful scheme which may not be mechanically practicable, so we may conceive some life ideal which is not according to cosmic law and consequently is unworkable. But if our scheme is feasible, life will flow into it and realize it. Circumstances are formed by personality to a far greater degree than we realize. According to our natures, we contact or avoid the influences of our environment. Change the personality, and it will tune into a different set of environmental influences. We see this in the case of a man who takes to drink. We see it in the case of a man who gets religion. We could see it in our own case if we set to work systematically to use mind power. The initiate builds himself a mass corpus owner, to use the technical term of the mysteries. He does this by imagining himself in an imaginary mirror in that likeness. His mental image will affect not only his own consciousness, but the attitude of others towards him, and their attitude towards him will reinforce the effect on himself of his own mental work. Let us practice and experiment along those lines in order that we may shadow forth the shape of things to come. The 26th of January 1941, in the Desert War in Africa, British and Australian troops take Tobruk and continue to push back the Italian fascists on all fronts. There are nuggets of information on other practicalities of occultism, in letter 58, on the method of using symbols. Letter number 58, for January 26, 1941. As all who have worked with us know, we work with a pictorial system of group meditation, visualizing images, scenes instead of the more usual metaphysical contemplation. Our method is not without precedent, however, for it is that of the Egyptian and Tibetan initiates and is known in the Western world as the composition of place, taught by Ignatius Loyola in his exercises. It is, in fact, both of these things, and they are mutually reinforcing, not mutually exclusive. The use of symbols, and especially the combination of the symbols into a glyph, needs to be thoroughly understood if it is to be applied intelligently and its full scope rendered available. In order to obtain real insight into its nature, we must go back to the beginning of things and see upon what it is based and how it came into being. Those who have studied the cosmic doctrine will recognize the principles to which it relates. The beginning of manifestation may best be represented under the concept of currents of force moving through space. These, by their inherent nature, are organized in course of cosmic time into the rings and the rays. Those again became coordinated into vortices of force that possessed stability. The vortices in their turn became organized into constellations of units of stability. The details of the process of the evolution of form substance cannot be entered upon here, and this brief outline must suffice. Each phase of evolution produced a particular type of organization of the units of pre-matter. A phase built up its basic units by coordinating the units of its predecessor, which in their turn had been built up out of the units of the earlier phases. Only a modicum of each form of basic substance was utilized, so that the greater part remained, coexisting with both earlier and later forms of development, just as in a lake may be found all forms of life, from unicellular protozoa through the worm, insect, fish and frog types, up to the water birds and others. Thus every phase of the evolution of animal life is represented. We must never think of the planes as lying in layers, one above the other, but as interpenetrating and built up into each other's substance, so that if one breaks up the substance of a plane, it disintegrates into its component parts as the substance developed during an earlier phase of evolution. All manifestation on all planes is thus built up, and so is our own fourfold being. Our vehicles of consciousness are formed of the substance of the corresponding plane, just as our physical bodies are formed of calcium, iron, phosphorus and other elements of the physical plane, and just as there is a constant circulation of substance between our bodies and the world of matter through the intake of food and the output of energy, so is there a similar circulation between our subtle vehicles and their conditions influence us. Civilized man, however, has concentrated on the focus of consciousness to the exclusion of all else, and his subtler powers of perception have, in consequence, been overlaid by superficial accretions and atrophied for lack of use. Primitive man, however, was aware of the subtle sensations arising from the influence of the inner planes impinging on the substance drawn therefrom that was incorporated in his being. Seeking to understand the nature of that of which he was thus made aware, he projected his own nature upon it, attributing by analogy his own methods and motives to the intangible life he felt around him. In this he was probably approximately correct, for it may be presumed that the same principles of organization prevail throughout the long history of evolution. Primitive man represented his concepts of the world order in pictorial form and dramatized them into myths. Such pictures and myths consequently correspond to conditions of pre-matter with which he was much better acquainted than we are, and when we want to contact these levels of existence, we shall avail ourselves of his methods, employing the subconscious mechanisms which correspond to the primitive phase of mental development. Thus we set flowing currents of force between the subtler aspects of our own fourfold being and the corresponding levels of the inner planes. In order to achieve this, we connect up the conscious mind with the subconscious by filling the conscious mind with the kind of contents that occupy subconsciousness and imitating its methods. Thus we take one or another of the racial myths that have come down to us traditionally from prehistory, and we dramatize it either in meditation as composition of place and colloquy, to borrow the terminology of Saint Ignatius, or as a dramatic ritual or mystery play. When we do this, consciousness, subconsciousness and superconsciousness are brought into alignment, and there is a straight run-through of cosmic force. Shortly afterwards, in her 65th letter, Diane Fortune gives quite specific instructions on the working of astral magic as a force in the general war effort. This is sparked by various publications of the time that sought to foster an attitude of hatred toward the German people. While she considers such an attitude unregenerate and unwise, she concedes that there might be a special problem with the racial soul of Germany. Of two authorities she cites, Sir Robert Vansittart stressed what he saw as an undying hatred of the average German for England, despite other English visitors to pre-war Germany having reported the kindliness and friendliness of individual Germans. While Lewis Spence, in his book The Occult Causes of the War, expressed a belief in an organized force of intelligent occult evil active in Germany that was definitely anti-Christian, Diane Fortune draws her own conclusions, which she here expresses, together with an invitation to her group to do something about it.